Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. The that are known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. It then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the far more you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. You're over the road. You don't want to deal with the call process. You're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password. Therefore, you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But you also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at your remedies in the law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Excuse me. Well, Martin, thank you so very much for that disclaimer. As usual, I've got something to say on the matter. And give me 1 second because I just had a computer crash and it's going to take me half a second to get back to where I was. Somewhere here. almost there. There we go. Now, this is a different phrasing of what we were talking about before, which was the definition of United States. There's three definitions we talked about. The standing 1945 Supreme Court decision of the term United States is found in Hooven and Allison Company versus Abbott. It's at 324 U.S. 652. The term United States may be used in any one of the several senses. It may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. That's number one. Number two, it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. Or number three, it may be the collective name of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. Black's Law 6th edition restates that and says United States. The term has several meanings, and it just repeats what I just said. And this is in Black's Law 6th edition. So which one are you? In the first, I am a citizen of the United States, like you are a citizen of China or Canada. Here you have defined yourself as a national from a nation which regards is in regards to other nations. It's perfectly okay to call yourself a citizen of the United States. That is what everybody thinks the state the tax statutes are inferring to, but it's not. Notice in the written expression, citizen of the United States, that the C is capitalized. Go back to your basic English to understand what that capital C means. The second definition, I'm a United States citizen. Here you have defined yourself as a person having domicile in the District of Columbia, having residence within one of the freely associated compact states, or you are domiciled in one of the territories or federal enclaves. An enclave is an area within the state, within one of the several states of the Union. Or you're living abroad, which could be one of the states of the Union as in a foreign country. Therefore, you are possessed by the entity United States, meaning the Congress assembled, because citizen, in this case as it's written, is with a small c for the word citizen instead of capital C. Again, go back to basic English. This is the United States that tax statutes are referring to. Unless otherwise stated, such as in 26 U.S.C. 6103 B5. Third is, I'm a citizen of the United States. Here you have defined yourself as a citizen of one of the 50 states united by and under the Constitution. You are not possessed by the Congress, meaning the United States. In this way, you have a national domicile, if you would, not a state or a United States domicile, and you're not subject to any instrumentality or subdivision of the corporate governmental entities. It is noticeable that the possessions of the United States are sovereign states of the United States of America, and they are not joined under the title of United States. The president represents the sovereign United States in foreign affairs through treaties. Congress represents the sovereign United States in territories and possessions with rules and regulations. And the state citizens are the sovereignty of the United States united by and under the Constitution. After becoming familiar with these historical facts, it becomes clear that in the Internal Revenue Code at 7701A9, the term United States is defined in the referenced second definition of these senses as stated by the Supreme Court. It designates the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. The federal zone over which the sovereignty of the United States extends is the District of Columbia, the territories, possessions belonging to the Congress, and a limited, very limited amount of land within the states of the Union, and those are called federal enclaves. Now, understanding what was just said, you have clearly delineated three separate people and three separate lands. Don't you think for just one moment that it would be important that when the state comes against you with a prosecutor, that it would be so incredibly important that the prosecutor, as the lead tell-all for the state, would want to put into the record the land jurisdiction and the personam jurisdiction of whoever the defendant is? Wouldn't you think? I mean, that would be smart. It certainly would be necessary. How would you know what your rules are that you're going to engage with? How are you going to know what laws are applicable to you if you don't have this established? I mean, it's no different than if somebody from Russia were to charge you with a crime on Russian soil, having committed it on American soil, and prosecute you as a Russian citizen when you are a United States citizen. How can that be? It can't. And within these three separate delineations of definitions, one can't bridge to the other. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to PJ, and maybe he'll make some magic here and share with us how this applies to what PJ does. Back to you, Guy.
Yes, it's a lot of people don't realize that the court must get that on the record, and the judges, the administrator is sitting up there, and he's checking them off mentally or on a paper. And they normally get the territorial jurisdiction on the record, the false pretense that it occurred inland where the written law that they're applying operates, which is a federal zone. If you're in California, you're 34% of the land there is governed by written law. The rest of the land is governed by common law, which is basically the jury of 12. The written law is the legislative written laws of the United States and the U.S. Constitution, and, of course, the Supremacy Clause kicks in, and any law that the state, individual state legislatures put together, it has to be compliant with the under the Supremacy Clause, which is means it has to be compliant with the Constitution for the United States of America. But in common law, it's not written law. And generally, historically in America, common law has always been biblically based. Now, of course, we're getting away from that. Abortion is not biblically based. It's demonically based. Theft is not biblically based, which is a great part of taxation, is just organized theft. It may be property tax, sales tax in many cases, and income tax, for example. So what I'm getting at is that if you were in California, it's very possible that you did an activity in land where the written law applies, 34% of it. There's 34% chance that you did. Now, most of that 34% is kind of fenced off and highly restricted to the public because it's basically military property. Not all of it, but a lot of it is you just can't go in at all, or very few people can go in. So that's what you have to be thinking about when they come after you. You have to be extremely diligent in your paperwork and your affirmative defenses and your bill of particulars that you submit to them, forcing them in the early stages. Don't wait for trial for this, because if you're going to trial, it's a uphill battle, because then you're stuck with the appeals and the judges just rule against you, and they just simply say that the judges basically tell us that, yeah, we know you're right, but we're told to just deny it, and hopefully you'll drop the ball in the appeals court which it's the appeals system is so difficult that most attorneys can't even maneuver them through all the landmines. So when you're in a basic U.S. court, may it be property taxes, parking tickets, state taxes, everything. If you're in a state court, they have to get on the record that you did the activity inland where their written law operates, and they do that by oftentimes, at least in my situation, they tried to get me in the witness chair to testify that it occurred in the county and city, county, state. And if you agree to that, if you testify to that, the judge takes it as sufficient evidence that he has subject matter jurisdiction, that the law is being declared properly, the activity of the law is being declared property of where it occurred. Now, the second area where they get that evidence on the witness stand is the attorneys will quite often state that it occurred in the county or the city or the state or the United States. And if you don't object to it, they just got it on the record. They're not supposed to do that easily, but I've witnessed the judges allowing that. I challenged land jurisdiction probably 20 times during a proceeding, and the judge got done. And I asked him, well, where did they prove up land jurisdiction of the application of the written law? And she said, they did it. They did it. And then I asked her for findings and facts and conclusions of law of it, and she did not provide it. She just simply said that they provided sufficient evidence for that. Never did indicate the exact words or who said it, which is then I tried to sue them in federal court, and the federal courts just dismissed my case. And we're trying to go back on that case and get it reestablished. And we should, in the name of justice, we should be able to do that. And we probably will. It's just going to take some time. The country is not lost. There's still a provision to get in there and get the, believe it or not, a lot of these judges, if you sit down and talk with them long enough, they actually agree with good law. They start realizing, a lot of them have realized that statism is not a utopia, and that it leads to just a bad society, and sometimes a very bad society. And then another area in the courtroom where they try to get on the record is that they simply ask you. Back to territorial jurisdiction. The officer. The third area they'll get is the officer in the witness stand, and they'll ask them, "Where did this activity occur?" And then they'll start rattling off this highway, the street intersection, the county, and the city, and you have to object and ask for a more clarative statement. Are they referring to land, city, county, state that is of the United States or without the United States? And the judge will fight you tooth and nail on it. They'll laugh at you. They'll mock you. And you can just explain to them that, I work with some individuals that have a brief that will submit to explain this to you, Your Honor. Would you like to know would you like to have that brief? We'd like to submit that brief in the next 7 days. And they can't say no to that. And we submit a brief with lots of judicial notices on it. It paints them right back into a corner. I've done that before, and the highest level prosecutors in the nation have resigned from their job. Because once they've been noticed of that, they can no longer operate in that office, at least the way it's really supposed to operate in the United States system, because they would not be able to prosecute most of their cases because they don't have jurisdiction territorially. Then the next jurisdiction they want to get on the record is, of course, what Michael's talking about is the other area is citizenship. They can govern activity on their land, and they can govern their persons. Excuse me, I'm yawning here. I'm in Central Time, so it's not that late here. I feel sorry for you guys on the East Coast. But they need to get on the record in a lot of situations. If they don't have, like in the tax, United States taxes, 1040 tax form, there's two main nexuses. They have to have one of two main nexuses. They either have to have you doing activity in their land, which makes the 1040 tax form required, or you have to be evidenced as a United States citizen. It doesn't make where you make the income. The 1040 tax form is required to be filled out, and the tax is required to be paid. So they strive to get the territorial jurisdiction. And now if they fail there, they really try hard to get the personal jurisdiction into the record. And a lot of times they'll slip in something right at the end, and the people don't know how to object. It might be a document that you signed 20 years ago that you're a United States citizen. In some cases, we've seen that. And the people just didn't know how to object. It doesn't make you how many papers you sign that you are a United States citizen. If you're not a United States citizen, you can sign papers all your life for 100 years. It doesn't make you a United States citizen. But, of course, the judge wants that on the record so he can have immunity from prosecuting you without evidence of judicial standing. So what they do is they get you. For example, they got me in the witness chair, and they asked me, PJ, where'd you go to school? What'd your parents do for a living? What'd you do for an occupation? Did you enjoy being raised in Nebraska? And I said, I just replied. I said, then they said, you're a U.S. citizen, aren't you? And that's the only time the prosecutor was nice and smiley during the entire trial. She's a very poor actor. Anytime they start smiling at you and they start being kind to you, they're a snake in the grass. They're lying through their teeth. They're being deceptive. They're slithering up that tree and they're talking to you. Just like they talk to Eve. The snake talked to Eve. Real cunning. But anyway, as soon as that happened, I just simply said, what'd you say? There's noise in the background there.
Well, the thing, PJ, is as soon as somebody asks you if you're a United States citizen, why wouldn't you come back and say, well, would you please stipulate one of the three definitions of United States citizen you wish me to acknowledge?
I don't recommend to do that because it's way too complicated. I'm getting an echo on my phone here. I think it's coming from somebody's got their speakerphone on. But
everyone's muted except thee and me.
All I did was you might want to mute yours because I'm getting a pretty bad echo on this slide.
Okay.
Okay. I'm still getting an echo. Echo. The echo went away. The prosecutor asked me that question. This is federal court. They're trying to put me away they're claiming they got enough charges to put me away in jail for 35 years, which is a joke. But when they asked me all those questions and with a big smile, I just simply said, I have no evidence in my possession that I ever elected to become a United States citizen. And it just completely shifted the burden of proof to somebody else or to the prosecution especially. And I was the only person that won a case in the Northern District of Florida in 8 or more years. The only case that went to trial in federal court where the individual prevailed. The U.S. Marshal walked up to me and walked me out of the courtroom. And he says, I've been here 8 years, and nobody since I've been here that went to trial has ever won a case except you. He says, I'm impressed. He didn't know why I won, but he said, I'm impressed. They had to get that nexus on the record because they didn't have any territorial jurisdiction. They didn't have any anything else for personal jurisdiction. They had to dismiss the case. It was the IRS case. So very interesting. It's one thing to remember that when you go into an IRS case and some lawyer walks up to you and say, hey, I'll help you through this case, $150,000, or at least a $50,000 retainer, and most of them are $150,000. And, you know, the chances of you winning a case with an attorney in an IRS case, it's so close to zero, it's pathetic. It's like 1%. And it's not because of the attorney. It's probably because they had a horrible, horrible, horrible case. But it should be criminal for somebody to charge you $150,000 with 1% chance of succeeding. You know, you got to pay. You got to give somebody $150,000 to get you from America to Europe, and only out of every 100 people that pay, only one of them makes it. Every jury would say that's fraud. That's fraud. That's deceptive. They don't tell you that up front. And you know, they, oh, I got to hire an attorney because I don't have no chance. You don't have no chance with an attorney. That's the truth. And they preach and preach and preach that if you don't have an attorney, you are a fool, an absolute fool. Well, gather the evidence of how many cases in an IRS case, for example, that the attorney wins for his clients. It's virtually zero. It's zero. So how can you be a fool for refusing to pay $150,000 for an attorney that has absolute assurance that you're going to lose? He's actually placed there to make sure you lose. That's why he's there. They'll be so nice to you. If you get an attorney, let's say you get one appointed to you in a criminal situation. If you get an attorney, he'll be so nice to you. He'll tell you how much he's going to help you, and you know, we got a good chance here. He's there because he works for the government. He's going to make sure you lose. All he's going to do, and I've seen it over and over and over, all he's going to do is make sure that it looks like he's trying to prevail, but he really doesn't challenge the very jurisdiction that Michael Edwards brings up every week. He doesn't challenge personal jurisdiction. He doesn't challenge subject matter jurisdiction. He doesn't challenge territorial jurisdiction, which is a type of subject matter jurisdiction. Because he can't. He can do it, but he'll get blacklisted in the Bar Association. They'll disassociate him. He might not jerk his license, but he's going to lose $2 million because he'll get blacklisted and they won't send clients his way for the rest of his life. And anybody that associates with him, they're going to blacklist him too. So, you know, if let's say Michael was an attorney and I was an attorney, and everybody's been told to blacklist Michael. If I'm found doing business with him, another attorney's going to walk up and say, hey, I had a client for you. He would have gave you $10,000, but you've been helping Michael. So, you know, I'm going to take it somewhere else. But I just lost $10,000. And that's how they control that racket. It's a criminal organization. Not all the lawyers in that association are criminals, but the vast majority of them are. And the ones that are not criminals are pretty much under the thumb of the criminals. I've seen it over and over and over. It's horrific. So, Michael, is there any questions out there? Michael might have walked away. You got it on mute yet. Anyway, okay. So I'm not a big advocate of people establishing their status, because let them tell you what they claim they have as evidence to bring the written law against you and to bring you in front of a United States court, the United States selected jury. And then you can examine that with with our eyes, and your chances of prevailing are quite well. Very, very, very much well. I'm getting beeped here. I don't know if somebody's trying to text me. I better take a look here. Oop, Michael's rebooting, so I don't even know if I'm on the air anymore. But I'll keep talking anyway. Talk to me, Michael. I don't know if I'm on the air or not. I'll keep talking because there's a chance that I am on the air. I got to check. I just got another text. You are live. Okay. Michael's telling me that I am live. Okay. So there's what we're talking about predominantly on these things is I think Michael said he's muted. That's why he's not. Okay. I think he has to boot up just to unmute him, unmute himself. I don't know for sure. But so you got in court, you got personal jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction. Most even patriot-minded legal minds do not challenge territorial jurisdiction. They used to. I talked to some high-level lawyers that they said they used to challenge territorial jurisdiction, but they don't so much anymore directly. They do it in other ways. They basically, instead of opening that can of worms, they force the opposing party to produce the evidence that your activity is not lawful, or you don't have a right to do what you're doing. We have one case right now where a dentist is being prosecuted. They're trying to take about $1 million from him and throw him in jail. And we've got some excellent briefs that we've assembled, and we've been working on these briefs for, I think, over 15 years with the help of retired high-level judges, which thought it was horrible that they were sending people to jail for simply exercising their right of their choice of vocation. So we're challenging the federal courts to produce evidence that if you're making income independent of the United States, which means not on their land, how can it be taxable? Now, they can regulate activity on their land. If you want to sell orange juice or lemon juice on the street corner, they can make you have a license to do so because it's their land. If I walk on your land and set up a lemonade stand, you can regulate me completely off of that land. The only thing you can't regulate me is basically having a reasonable passageway through your land. So if you own a square mile of land in America, you generally have a road every square mile. Not always, but generally in America, that's the way it works, at least every square mile. Some areas it's not that way because they don't have, nobody's complaining because they don't have any reason to go that direction. So they have another road that they take that's much easier to pass through. It might be through mountains or something like that. But what these lawyers are telling me, that you simply put in the proper discovery and you force them to tell you exactly what they rely upon for this dentist, for example, that he that his activity is not a God-given right. If it's a right, it cannot be taxed. If it's taxed, it cannot be a right. So they have to produce evidence that that individual at a specific location, pulling teeth and putting cavities, fixing cavities, is doing it either as a God-given right or a state-granted privilege. And a lot of these federal judges that we're working with, many of them are deceased because they're older when they started helping in this project, that they believe we have a tremendous, tremendous case here because they cannot produce the taxable nexus, governable nexus. Almost everything the government does is connected to land jurisdiction. or personal jurisdiction. Now, this man never elected to become a United States citizen. So there's only one way you can become a United States citizen. You got to get in front of a magistrate and be sworn in as a United States citizen. Most Americans say they're United States citizens. Most Americans have never stood in front of a judge and been sworn in as American, a United States citizen. Therefore, as a matter of law, they're, and that's the only thing that matters in law, in the U.S. court, is that they're not a United States citizen. But they always hire an attorney. And guess what? If you hire an attorney, you waive a lot of your protections. Because an attorney can only represent a legal fiction. He can't represent a man. So you actually convert yourself into a, it appears to me that you convert yourself into a legal fiction that's regulated, governed, franchised under the United States written laws, much like a corporation. So there goes your personal jurisdiction defense, I believe. I'm not for sure, but it's very possible. We have never won a case with an attorney involved in IRS cases. We've won probably over 100 cases with no attorney involved. What's that tell you? Hiring an attorney is the worst thing you can do, even if it's your wife, even if it's your brother-in-law, even if it's your husband, or your brother, or your father, or your son. Do not hire an attorney. We can put the challenges in there that an attorney is not allowed to do. See, an attorney cannot take you on as a client because he's taking you on and you're converted to a fiction because he cannot represent a man. He can only represent a legal fiction. So how is he going to argue that you have the you're afforded the Bill of Rights? Legal fictions are not afforded the Bill of Rights. How can your own attorney argue that? He can't do it. So he's got his hands tied. He's between a hard spot and a rock. Even if he wanted to help you, as soon as he did it, the judge would call him into chambers and say, you can't do that. Why not? You're the attorney. The attorneys represent legal fictions. You can't come here and argue that that guy's not a legal fiction as long as you're his attorney. No. So, Michael, come on back. Michael must be having a terrible time. Apparently, these computers, when they need to reboot, I think the phone lines still stay connected. Fortunately, and everybody that's on the program is still hearing what I'm saying. That's what Michael's indicating to me. It's 8:45, so I got another 15 minutes to jabber. Usually we take this time for questions. What else can we talk about here? I'm trying to think of another case that's very interesting. Recently, as far as the COVID thing goes, we've the individual I work with met with, I think, 200 sheriffs and 50 governors. And they had specific questions on jurisdiction. One of the biggest things that we're bringing into the arena with the group of people I work with is the incorporation of the Bill of Rights into our positions before the United States courts. The United States courts cannot stand against a right. They can't talk about it. They can't regulate it. They can't take it away. They can't add to it. They can't do anything to it. The United States legislature cannot even convene to talk about a right. They have no authority to talk about man's rights. So what we try to communicate to our clients, no matter what their profession is, to show them how to conduct that profession, that activity, that income without the United States. The 1040 tax form is a document that is designed to calculate the tax for persons, not man, for persons that have an income from activity domestically in the United States. A person that has income domestically in the United States. If you have income domestically in the United States, you're classified as a person. You cannot be classified as a man. You have a obligation to obey the written laws of that land jurisdiction. Now remember I said in the United States. If you're in California and you're in that 34% land base, you have to pay taxes on your activity there. If you're not doing activity in that 34%, the only nexus they can get to you is through United States citizenship. So that I know of. There might be a few others, but that's the main one. And that's the burden. They have to prove that in court. Now, if you're in California on land that is of California, that's not land of the United States, then you're doing an activity. They have to prove that activity is taxable, and they're probably going to have a horrible time doing it. And if it's not taxable, they're not going to want to do it because they don't want nobody to know that activity is not taxable. They don't want anybody to figure out the checklist to find out if you're required to fill out a 1040 tax form. They are hiding that up. 90 years ago, probably 80 years ago, I think the federal taxes basically began through a victory tax, and it was only like 1.5% or 0.5% of your income. And nobody complained because they won the war, and everybody was pretty happy. And the war actually caused a booming economy, and a lot of people had money, and they didn't have any problem paying their fair share, which is 1.5%, which they didn't have to pay. That was a donation. And then the government got people on that list, and they started sending out those forms every year, and little by little they bumped it up. Now, some years people have to pay 90% of their tax base. If they make $100,000, they got to pay $90,000 into taxes in some years. It's been very few years like that. I think it was in 1985 under Jimmy Carter. The taxes were 85 or 90%. What an idiot. If that was his way of rescuing the country, is by taking all the wealthiest people's wealth. That's called theft. But anyway, most wealthy people are not intelligent enough to or brave enough to actually study the issue, and they have a pretty fabulous life, even if they have to give a good portion of their wealth away. But I don't care if I was worth $100 million. I still would not want to give a dollar to a criminal. That is just not right. Michael, could you text me? I'm going to close up this call here in a few minutes because I'm running out of things to talk about. Why don't you – I'm looking at the texts right now. And it just says here – the last thing you text me is at 8:36 p.m. Central Time, basically saying I'm muted. So if I don't see a text from you in a few minutes or 30 seconds, I'm going to go ahead and call it a night. I'm trying to think of a few other things that if you are interested in joining a class action lawsuit, if you've been paying taxes – and you know you're getting ripped off and you've been paying taxes for, I think, at least 7 years, I believe you have to be. We are running a class action suit, and we are forcing the government to answer a question. And the basic question is, if your activity is of a right, where in the Constitution do they get the right, the authority to tax you on that income?
for forcing the government to do that. Okay, I'm going to close her up. So see you later, alligator. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference. The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.